I'd like to welcome you to our evening forum tonight, entitled The Arms Race, What's in It for Me? In a minute, Jack Hinter will lay the theme out in case a few of you was not at the last session with Dan Erlander. But before that, it has not a whole lot to do with the arms race, but I just happened to have been reading the dictionary today. And I came across the word deity to show you the poverty that we live in today in America. The third definition is a person or thing that is exalted as supremely good or great. Such established American deities as Daniel Boone and Kit Carson. I just had to share that. I thought it was so profound. Now on to some other matters. Jack.
Thank you. Three books I'd like to hold up. But one is the one we discussed at 7 o'clock by Faith Alone, a very confessional and heartfelt statement with a study guide to come, right, Dan? Another one. He hopes. Ground Zero has a book called Nuclear War, What's in It for You, on sale at the bookstore. Good source of information. It's a nonpartisan, nationwide group, not related to Ground Zero at Bangor, but with much the same thrust. And then another book, I'm not sure if you have ever heard of this, called The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, deals with some of the same basic issues that this touches on very poignantly. To deal with the issue then, one of the probably most important books recently that's come out is called The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell, something that a lot of you have heard about. This is a Xerox of the excerpts that were in the New Yorker magazine last February. I spent the afternoon going through that. And the reason that I would recommend that book and Becker, particularly, as well as Dan's very well done book that can be used for discussion, is that it touches some of the very basic issues that the whole business of the arms race brings up, because it's essentially a search for security. I'd like to start us off by just reading a few short quotes from Schell's book and then throw it open to questions and comments. One of the things he says is that a society that systematically shuts its eyes to its peril, to its physical survival, and fails to take any steps to save itself cannot be called psychologically well. In the book, he makes an analogy with a cruise ship where, if you look at it like the love boats on the TV show, everything looks very normal. People singing, laughing, talking, playing games, and so forth. And yet, if the scene would shift to a typhoon that's in its path, and then you flash back to the boat and that same kind of activity is going on, suddenly it takes on a very different kind of cast. Radioactive poisoning in the atmosphere, and hence annihilation of life on Earth, has been brought within the range of technical possibilities. And that's a quote from Albert Einstein. Some people doubt the technical things, and it's not my purpose, and I think we want to try to avoid, in fact, tonight getting too technical about what some of these things mean. But a fairly substantial authority there has said that the annihilation of life on Earth is entirely within the possibility, the technology which we now possess. Looked at in its entirety, Schell goes on, a nuclear holocaust could be said to assail human life at three basic levels, the level of individual life, the level of human society, and the level of the natural environment. And at none of these can the destructiveness of nuclear weapons be measured in firepower alone. We live in a universe which contains an energy with which we can extinguish ourselves. We know this, and we will never stop knowing this, and we will never stop living inside this knowledge. One of the things that he talks about, and the thing that's probably the most frightening in terms of making me stop and thinking, oh, gee, this really is an issue that I have not dealt with adequately, is his idea of what he calls the second death. According to the Bible, when Adam and Eve ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge, God punished them by withdrawing from them the privilege of immortality and dooming them and their kind to die. This is Schell's interpretation of that. Now our species has eaten more deeply of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and has brought itself face to face with a second death, the death of humanity. In doing so, we have caused a basic change in the circumstances in which life was given to us, which is to say that we have altered the human condition. Formerly, the future was simply given to us. Now, it must be achieved. Let me repeat that, and that's the last one. Formerly, the future was simply given to us, and now the future must be achieved. The book, The Fate of the Earth, is on sale at the bookstore, which I think I've mentioned, and I'll turn it back over to Darius to get us going then on the discussion.
Let's just open it up to a discussion, either on things from the film, Ground Zero of Anger, some of your own personal struggles, anything left over from the book review, or anything that Jack has just mentioned now. What do you wish to talk about tonight, dealing with the arms race? We've all come to listen. Well, I have a story. Back in the 50s, my dad was going to build an addition onto our house. And he thought it was appropriate at that time to build a bomb shelter. So we proceeded to take a look at all the different criterion that you need, 3 feet of cement above you, so many feet of sand and the air vents. That was back when all those movies were around talking about that you got to store up a shotgun because if your neighbor comes in, you have to make sure that they stay out, otherwise everybody will die because there will be only so much oxygen in there to last. So my dad spent lots of money. Everything was done just according to the manual, except for the one last thing was putting a door on the shelter. Somehow, he couldn't bring himself to put that door on that shelter. He even stored his shotgun down there. One day, I came home from school, and I saw a wood door hanging on this shelter. And I asked my dad, why a wood door? And he said, it's my way of saying no to fear. Now, I've been theologizing about that for a long time. Dan's booklet deals directly with that, of saying no to the idol, no to whatever, but saying no to fear. We turned our bomb shelter into a fruit site. That's kind of my vision of shalom. We have a large group here tonight, so if we can speak up a little bit louder than most forums, I think it'd be helpful.
That tells me the civil disobedience that I see in that kind of a gesture. Because if we decide ourselves, or uniquely for ourselves, that because I'm concerned about the arms race, that I'm going to withhold that part of my taxes. What's to prevent me or somebody else from withholding part of their taxes because they don't believe in something else that they're being taxed for? And once that's opened up, it strikes me as a Pandora's box. I think in an open society that we live in, that can be addressed through the structures that we have, the courts and the process, the judicial process, rather than taking those kind of actions, because that troubles me, that I can decide against the laws of the land what I perceive to be the greater order. I think when we begin to do that, entertain those kind of feelings, we're on very shaky ground. I don't know that anybody's advocating that. I think that was a unique decision on that pastor's part, the bishop's part.
By the way, last week there was a forum on paying for taxes, praying for peace, and that dilemma. And so there has been some questions from that too, so please. Over here?
I have a question.
Yeah, well, okay, right here, right here, and then over here.
I think that we have to face head on your question, your concern. I wish I had a copy of the Augsburg Confession. I didn't memorize it. But what is it, Article 17 or 16? 16 deals with our relationship, our responsibility of Christians to the governing powers. And it suggests that in the normal circumstances, we would expect that we would observe the laws of the land and the leadership of those who rule, and that this would not be an occasion for sin for those who would serve as magistrates or would serve as soldiers, and so on. But there is an important exception in our Augsburg Confession. And that is that if we should become convinced that to follow the leadership of our land, that this would be sin, then we must follow what we perceive to be our responsibility before God rather than the king. And that remains usually a kind of an abstraction, and then it becomes a matter of conscience when you do you invoke it. But I would observe and propose that within our Lutheran heritage, we have to take seriously that possibility, and that we must never permit another deity to take over, whether that's our own United States or what have you. There may indeed be times, in principle, when we would have to stand against. But I don't think we would any of us, or ought to any of us, enter into that moment lightly. But I think we have to say that that principle of exception takes precedence over the rule. And that's a hard one to work with. The last time we saw this with any large numbers of our people dealing with it was during the Vietnam War. And we had difficulty then. But it's a part of the exercise of our faith, and indeed it opens a Pandora's box, it seems to me. It opens a Pandora's box. But the very freedom of which we've been speaking as Christians always is opening that box.
I have, maybe it's a funny question for this audience. I want to address it to you, though, as a Lutheran pastor. Why in your booklet did you confine yourself to Luther? I have a lot of Catholic friends, Methodist, Presbyterian friends that are just as afraid of nuclear war as any of us, or anything like that. And I also have a son-in-law for a Lutheran pastor who may think this is an odd question. But I'm wondering why you did that instead of taking in all of humanity. We don't have a corner on citizenship.
Good question. I would love to answer it, but Dan is the author of the book, so I'll pass it over to Dan.
I'd like to hear your
answer. Dan.
Oh, I think it's simple. There are, the Lutheran family is most specifically my family, and there are Roman Catholic people articulating the Pax Christi for Roman Catholics are doing a beautiful job of articulating the same concern. And I've read a wonderful Presbyterian book on the armed groups, and it was a decision to be specific about talking to my own family, and it could have gone either way.
Would there be anything in your book that would be uniquely Lutheran? I mean, there's much of it could be common tradition. Or just the unique way it was put together. I don't. Is there anything that you didn't find in those other books?
No, I. You could say that about anything Lutheran, that it has a certain ecumenical. Uh-huh.
Did that answer your question?
What are you?
C plus B minus.
Yes.
With the title of your book. Be diminished if you left out the reference to Lutheran or the thrust of your book.
I thought it was
less Lutherans would read it. I mean, what did you? I'm intrigued myself at what is our stance. I was like Dan. I could probably give about a 10-second statement on the Lutheran peace movement. And here, at least somebody has put together something that claims to be Lutheran that I can then look at and either embrace and say amen to or say he's all wet.
I think that we have a particular theological heritage that gives us a unique way of looking at what church can face the relationship between them. And I think that sometimes we have really not thought seriously enough from our own theological heritage but have used Reformed or Roman Catholic theological models rather than our own. And I think we have a particular message to bring to all of Christendom when we operate out of our own theological heritage. I also have a story to tell. I wish that in all of this some concern would be given to pastoral care of those who are caught in the machine. I heard earlier this evening a movie on the Holocaust and noticing how people simply got caught in the machine. And while we're thinking of how to deal with this on a national basis in terms of policy, I wish that someone could also do some thinking about how to minister pastorally to those who are now involved in a direct personal way. Before I took the job I have now a year ago, I was a pastor for 12 years, 20 miles from a track base, and many parishioners who were Air Force personnel. The some of you remember the maybe the rocket that they fired 4,000 miles, and this book is all wet on the estimates of accuracy. It hit within 20 feet where it was supposed to hit. After a journey 4,000 miles, and my parishioner pushed the button. I talked to him about what it meant to carry that kind of responsibility. I wasn't able to minister adequately to him. Subsequently, he and his wife left our church and became part of a charismatic group. My rationalization for my failure says, well, they were escaping. I really believe that. But whatever it was that they needed from me pastorally to deal with the enormous things that we talked about a number of times, I was not able to deal with. And others who were pilots. Same kind of dynamic. Just a plea for somebody to think about how those who carry pastoral responsibility for ministry might be better equipped for those unique persons that are caught in the machine.
The enemy is not the people that are in the military. The enemy is not people who build bombs, as has been quoted dozens and dozens of times. The enemy is us. This is something we are all doing to ourselves as a race, as a species. It's an ecological question as much as it's a question of whether or not we support people who work for the military. It's a far deeper issue than that. I feel that pain. And in a sense, the presence of evil masquerades as that which we need to do. Look at the evil that's done in the name of good. Look at all that happened in the Falklands and that's going on right now in the Near East. In the name, so much evil is done in the name of so much that is good. And I think that we need to own that issue ourselves, first and foremost. And I guess the thing I like about Dan's book is that it's not so much addressed to Lutherans as it speaks out of a Lutheran perspective. One of the gravest dangers that I see, what worries me so much, and I'm certainly no more a prophet than anyone else, but that there are a number of competing ideologies to which that story speaks directly that will attempt to help save and rescue us from a situation that's very terrifying. We're a fragile membrane away from the utter destruction of all that we know. And one of the best ways that we can handle that and the knot that it causes in our stomach is to run to some place that will alleviate our need to make hard decisions and to think about the ways in which we need to handle this for the rest of human history. We're always going to have bombs. So So I really appreciate that comment. I don't.
Yes, up there.
Well, if I really believe that the arms race is against my faith and that it puts my security in something other than God, and I sit around saying, this is awful, we're going to destroy ourselves, I don't know what I can do as a Christian if it isn't to be a tax resistor. And I guess I'm feeling more and more strongly that that's the only way I can be a conscientious objector, because I have control of my money. And when people say, yes, but I might lose my house or my farm, or they'll come and take my money, I have never been called upon in my life as a Christian to have a huge cost to what it means to fall in the way of the cross. And I guess when we think that there isn't any cost to an action that we take, we're just deluding ourselves. There is always a cost involved, and this for me might be the biggest cost that I'm ever asked to bear because of the sake of what I feel very strongly if I'm going to follow Jesus. So I don't know why we're so afraid to step out and take a stand like refusing to pay a portion of our taxes. It's a faithful response to a demonic kind of thing, and I see some people and some of our friends have done this, and I just wonder why we're so hesitant to try a risk like that.
Could you your hand up? Yeah, back here and then over here.
I think in deciding what we can do, we need to recognize how powerful and how resistant the decision-making forces are, the governmental and military forces. As an illustration of that, I want to tell about the Peace Office of the Ecumenical Council of San Francisco Bay Area, in which the Lutheran churches participate. For 7 years, they carried on a kind of campaign to try to change the policy that governs the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, which is one of the two research laboratories that develop the weapon systems for the Pentagon, and it's under the control of the University of California system. And this campaign involved appealing to the Board of Regents, speaking personally with the governor, carrying on educational campaigns with those regents, try to get them to either divest the university system of the laboratory or convert the laboratory into more peaceful activities. Something like 30% of the budget is devoted to peaceful research, but the rest of it primarily goes for arms development. And they even develop proposals for what that conversion process might be. So you can see that they put a great deal of intense effort into it for 7 years and made utterly no progress. In fact, at one point there was a point where the regents were to decide whether or not to let contracts again to the government for arms development. And instead of holding public hearings on this, there was a six-month waiting period during which the decision-making process was supposed to be made. Instead, they moved up the decision by several months and made it very quickly in a rather silent fashion instead of airing it with the public. So it almost was counterproductive for them to raise this seven-year campaign. And the woman who was directly involved with this over this entire period of time decided that it was really utterly hopeless, and that the only kind of activity, instead of, they even went through some court processes to merely get a peace display at the laboratory in their public visitor center, which is entirely devoted to the arms process. The lab wasn't going to allow them to have this display in the court and got it, or the threatened to go to court and were allowed to get that, and that's all the progress that they made. So she decided that all that was left was some kind of public, direct opposition type action. That's all she, if she were going to do anything more, that's what she would do.
Comment over here and then over here.
Well, again, I'd say I can't answer that particular scenario that you went through. But as long as we live in a, quote, open society, and I'd like to think of it as that, we don't live in a closed society, so we do have redress for our concerns, whether it be the voting booth, or as you mentioned, the judicial system. And I think your energies directed in this accepted and pragmatic way to go about change, if you can't make it that way, maybe you have to look at how well you marshaled your resources. I feel that once one person, or no matter how profound or how moralistic your stand is, you start to make those decisions on your own, that if it doesn't work, we'll take it to a certain point, and then if it doesn't work, now I can step out of the outside of the law. To me, when you do that, you make it, you're giving license to anybody else that feels maybe not like you do, maybe in some other facet. I've heard people say, as an example, how much does our social entitlement programs do to the Indian population? I'm told now that we have one federal employee that's salaried for every five Indians. I don't know if that's true or not, but if that's what it's taken to put the Indian in the place they are now, what worth is a social entitlement program for the Indian? A friend of mine says, I'm going to quit paying that part of my taxes. When he does that, he doesn't have my sympathy. I think we really have to look at what we're saying here.
Over here, then there, then there.
But I think that we're talking about something besides governmental waste here. I think there's a difference between that and the possibility of ending the world as we know it. I think those are two different, completely different issues. The comment that I'd like to make back from back here is, I don't know if the issue is so much results this fall or in August, whenever the Triton comes in. John Nelson's plan is to take a rowboat out in the middle of the waters of Puget Sound when the Triton comes in. I'm sure he'll be stopped way before that. But I mean, the irony of taking a rowboat out to stop at a nuclear submarine, which is how many blocks long and how many stories high, is crazy. I don't think the issue that he's planning on stopping, I think it's a statement. He's making a statement about what he believes as a Christian, telling the submarine, stop. And I think when we, if we would, in terms of withholding taxes, would there be $160 of Bishop Hunt? I don't think the money is the issue. I think we're making a statement. I won't pay it.
Parallels to the Munkin gladiators, possibly. Here, up there, and there, over here, and then over there. Please remember your order.
I guess what I want to say, pretty much in response to your...
A little lower.
Stand up and...
Stand up. I think the issue in civil disobedience is much more than simply the withholding act. Part of civil disobedience is going to jail after you have withheld. The people I've talked to are willing to go to jail. They would be almost upset if they were not sent to jail. And I think when someone, you know, if you've seen what jail time is like, people are not going to give up a year or a few months of their life in jail just for not paying a few more taxes. I think it's a real connection between how firmly they believe in it and the stakes they're willing to lay on their record.
What John says about that is that civil disobedience is a way of making a statement that can be made in no other way. And there's an obvious parallel with the civil rights movement, where a lot of people were telling Southern Christian Leadership Conference, well, we understand what you're saying, but if it could be a little bit less loud and interfering and just take it easy and things will be okay.
Yeah, I think that the gentleman in the back had a good question, because it was a struggle for me whether or not to try to work through the system through a political party or to be involved in some form of civil disobedience. But I guess I came to the conclusion after a while that I just found that I had a lot of problems working against the arms race at the same time as I was paying for that to continue with my own tax dollars. I was in essence paying someone else to do the job that I would not be willing to do. And I had to think, now that I am beyond the age of being eligible for the draft, am I still contributing to this war effort? And I realized that through my tax dollars I was. So I think for most tax resistors, they do not choose to break the law, but they just cannot in good conscience pay their taxes anymore. And as far as the floodgates argument goes, I don't think that holds a lot of water, just because I really don't think there is any other program that comes close to the amount of money we pay for war.
It's over 50% of our tax dollar right now, and I would be willing to bet that there isn't anything that's anywhere near that, probably nothing over 5%. And most people who are opposed to certain other issues are not morally opposed to them, but only disagree with this or that program. And I think war tax resistance has a very deep history in our country, which predates the Constitution. There have always been war tax resistors. There's a precedent for it in conscientious objectors now, which is allowable by law. And it only seems fitting that be extended to payment of taxes. So I think it's a much deeper concern than just disagreeing with a social program or a military policy. It's a firmly rooted religious, moral kind of thing that people can no longer pay.
I think you were back there, then here, and then here, if I remember right. Was there somebody back here? There wasn't?
It's not my turn.
Well, I'll take it anyway.
Okay, I would like to, this woman who said that she felt, up here, who said that she felt that by withholding her taxes that she was in a sense martyring herself because there was the possibility of being incarcerated for doing this, because there is. I mean, your chances of going to jail are probably pretty good. But there's a way you can withhold your taxes without going to jail, because I'm not paying any taxes at the moment. And last year I probably paid $10,000 in taxes, and this year I paid none, and I'm sitting right here and absolutely and under no danger of going to jail. And if I'd gone to jail, I wouldn't have a job anyway. You can always quit your job, and you won't pay a tax. And it's the same as going to jail. You're just sitting out there on the fringe. Making do, and if you believe in one another, you'll make out. Because I've been making out fine.
It's here.
Well,
thank you, Dan, for the book and the book review earlier, because it's the first time I've really thought about that. So bear with me if my thought is not completely thought out. I agree with the man in the corner I don't want to lose everything that I've got if it's not going to do anything. And I have that feeling that if we all went out in this room and we all didn't pay taxes, or the Lutheran Church went out and told all of its members that don't pay your taxes, I don't really think that would stop it. But it might. It would succeed if the Lutheran Church came out with that, and losing places like Holden Village, where we can talk about it and develop ideas. Why go to the button first? Why go to the nuclear weapon first? Why go to civil disobedience first? Why not try something? How did this all happen? My father paid for it. My grandfather paid for it. People manipulated politicians to support the arms race because it meant more jobs, meant more profit for General Dynamics, or for George Livermore, okay? Why are we going to an individual thing, which is great, because it's pretty self-fulfilling. I did everything that I could. It may not have done any good, but I did everything that I could, and that's, but is it accomplishing the mission of stopping the arms race? I think maybe if we backed off on that one thing, and that's maybe not a bad idea, but it's not the only idea. We keep bandying that thing about. John Nelson, I have a lot of respect for him. I don't think by him rolling a boat out into the middle of a Puget Sound is going to stop this thing. Okay, it is a start. But maybe, why don't we become our own political action committee to form those kinds of things that got this thing started in the first place? Change the images, I was taught by Gary Vee. You know, if the force is going this way, change something, okay? So we missed that point at the end, like Gary was teaching me the other night. I guess that's where I'm wrestling with it.
Did you have a comment? And then yeah. Back here, and then me, and then we'll get from our hands.
Well, I believe in political action, as you just mentioned. Last winter, the University of Oregon came down to our town and made us aware of this nuclear problem we've got. And I went and listened, and I read about it. So immediately, I was chairman of our men's club. I called a meeting, the following Saturday breakfast meeting, and spoke to the men on it, extracted a little information on it. We all wrote to Senator Hatfield. Hatfield returned an answer to us. Since that time, Hatfield and Kennedy are proposing, they propose to do something about this. Now, the Lutheran Church is probably one of the strongest political action groups in the country. How many of you in your churches have had meetings and talked about this in the men's club or ladies' club or evening sessions or so? I'm afraid not many. This is where you got to start. Then talk to your friends that belong to the Presbyterian, the Methodist Church, the Catholic Church. If they're working on this, that'll catch on. Don't think it won't. It's catching on in our town. Thank you.
Right behind you. I want to share some information because some people here may not have it. And that is that the Lutheran Church does have resources available for political action through the National Lutheran Council, an office maintained in Washington, D.C. I was part of a briefing last October in which the Lutheran Council participated with a total of 16 mainline denominations to cooperate together to speak to our national legislature on a variety of issues. Something that the Lutheran Council then buys into is called an impact network, which is concerned persons of all denominations that tracks legislative issues and sends out information when there is need to contact your congressman about them. The machinery that you kind of hinted at is in place already. The Western states have not been distinguished by their participation in this. I'm pastor in one of the Western states. And at the point in that briefing session where each state was invited to help to hold its individual caucus, the members from all 16 denominations that all meet the state groups. We held the caucus for my state in the phone booth while I called my wife. I don't know why the Western states are less active in the impact network than the others. But for those who want to be sure they work within the system, it's already there, set up through the denomination.
My comment is just to do a little clarifying here. I've heard some people talking about ways of working within the system to fight, maybe that's the wrong word, but to fight the arms race. There's ways of being civil disobedient that goes outside the law. I'm wondering if we made a jump there. I want to say there's another side of that. You know, is the arms race sinful? As I think people have been talking, assuming that, and I'm not sure. You know, where are we on the continuum? The arms race is good. We need it for our security. The arms race is bad or confusing. The arms race is sinful, and therefore I'm going to do everything I can within the law to change it. I've heard the arms race is so sinful and so corrupt, I and the conscience can't help but do everything in my power, even though it may mean I may suffer for it by breaking the law, either by taking a rowboat, or not paying taxes, or other methods. There's a lot of gap there, so if anybody wants to speak to any of those other segments, please do so. Now, where are the hands? There were hands. Right here and then up there.
As a woman, I'll talk now and say that I'm supportive of what my husband was saying, that we could act as citizens and I formed the doctor in Grant Pass, and their group is already together as this gentleman spoke today. And this group that we have started in Florence, the Friends Group, is very active and trying to do something about it. I'm just wondering how much support they're getting from, I'm sure we have a lot of counselors here. Because they seem to kind of hold back them coming out with anything in support of something different.
Up here, then there's a comment over here, and then over here.
I'd like to just see a poll on your continuum, so that you go ahead of where people individually are on this issue. Based on your continuum, you know, from we need it to it's so sinful that I'm willing to resort to any means to stop it.
Okay, we'll have five chances to raise your hand. Hand number one will be that I think that we need our arms built up for national security, and I'm all in favor of it. Number two would be, I'm confused about it, I'm struggling with it, I don't know where I stand exactly, I'm somewhere in between. The third step would be, it is sinful, and I'm going to do everything I can within the law. The fourth is, it is sinful, and I'm going to take some sort of act, it's struggling with the act of civil disobedience. And the fifth one is, I refuse to make a comment at this time. Okay? Okay, how many vote for number one? Okay. You? Okay. How many are confused somewhere?
Can you separate number one? Are you talking nuclear or all defense?
Oh, nuclear.
In my opinion, it's sinful, then, and I'm not ready to say it's okay, but there may be some who say it's sinful, but it's okay, because we live in a crazy, mixed-up, sinful world.
Maybe sinful but necessary, that's kind of a...
Well, I don't know, but anyway, I think I should say it's only the last three identified as sinful.
Yeah.
Or maybe comfortable.
I have a question. Yeah. All this talk is fine and all that, but... I'm a good Christian as well as the rest of you, I think, and hope. I'm real patriotic. But I'm very confused. Has anybody yet, in all of this talk, ever said what the Russians will do? They're atheists. They're communists. How are you going to talk to them? We can do all we want to, but if we don't have any arms at all, what are we going to do in the long run? That's my argument. Nobody's talking about the other side at all.
I have another question related to war tasks and things. Being a student and having worked part time, I really haven't had to pay taxes per se. But I have, like, through my phone bill, not paid my portion of the federal tax that goes to war and stuff too. And the other day, someone raised a question to me having to do with war tax that I didn't really know how to answer. And that was, by not paying my portion of taxes that goes to war, how much am I really cutting down on the amount that's spent for the arms buildup, and how much am I hurting the amount that's kind of in the general pool for taxes that goes to other things, like social programs, et cetera, and how much, I mean, is the portion I'm not paying just not being taken out of the war budget, or is that kind of contributing to cuts across the board?
I got a few just to answer that directly, and if it's not direct, somebody else wants to answer it. I think most people who resist paying part of their portion of their income tax is not because of any sort of that this will go to do something else. They may put that money into a pool to do that, but it's a symbolic gesture to say that this war or the buildup of arms is immoral. Is that, anybody else has a different opinion of that? Okay, and then Oscar, you have a comment?
I was going to make an observation that if I have been reading rightly, the Lutheran news releases from the American Lutheran Church, our presiding bishop and each of our district bishops agreed that primary social concern focus that they're going to be having during this next year and more have to do with questions of peace and justice. In other words, if you're asking is there leadership in the church that is speaking out, yes, there is leadership in the church that is seeking to find ways to address this question I think we're talking about.
Thank you.
Well, I'm John Lutheran, I'm Presbyterian. And I have a concern. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the United Presbyterian stance, but for the last few years we've come out with some fairly strong statements and also a lot of activity in the area of teaching, believers' calling is the name of the program. But I know in our denomination there's a lot of activity in this area and a lot of interest, but as there has been for quite a number of years, a real lack of activity and a real lack of concentrated effort in the area of reaching out to those friends, neighbors, and others in our communities that are just as lost eternally as will be the entire world, you know, in this nuclear holocaust. And I'm a little concerned, well, I'm really concerned within my own area of influence and experience, including my denomination. I'm wondering where the position of your church and this body of people is with regard to the salvation of their friends and their neighbors. I mean, are we putting so much energy here and so much thought and concern that we're missing some of the concern for some really basic Christian areas?
Yeah. Okay. You want to respond to that and then over here.
So I'd like to make a response to that out of a statement made by Bishop Troitz, or presiding bishop of the American Church of the North Pacific District Convention a week ago. And he said that the two most important issues for the church today are first evangelism and then peace. But he said that's what the priority is. Well, at least the president of the American Lutheran Church.
Hopefully it's not an either or, but a both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm reading a dead horse, but I think it gets back to the challenge question in the corner. And here's up here. If I'm a student also, so the government didn't need that. And I understand that I can write to them and ask for more of that back, and then they can make that decision. But how do I know, if I'm withholding tax, that that's not, that that's really going to be taken out of the defense budget, that it's not something, it's not stealing from something else? How do I know that? And I think that's what he was talking to that. Are we going to set a precedent? I mean, there's a large community here, and it will, if it's spoken of often enough, it could get to be quite large. Are we going to set a precedent of the attacks that are serious and how many there are? Am I taking out my even fraction of money? That's going to make a difference to the general good of the country, the lonely.
And hopefully it's not only in the evangelism question, it's not only an either or, hopefully it's a both and. If you do, if you are a tax resister, hopefully you do still work within the political arena as well. I would hope that. But the comment,
right here? Yeah, the idea that if you withhold your taxes, that's going to somehow stop the arms race, I think that, from my own point of view, that seems kind of naive. Because nothing that I do with my $2,000 is going to change until the men in that Congress up there have a change of virtue in their own heart and say, hey, we're going to vote against it. Because I can do anything I want to do. I can go to jail as long as until my bones, you know, decay. And as long as there are people in the Congress that are voting for more military budget, you know, the only other answer is to go like the other countries just overthrow the government every time they don't like something that's going on in the country. I don't think that's what I want to do.
Isn't that always the call of the gospel, to stand sometimes apart from business as usual? It's always a painful, difficult, prophetic thing to hear. If we wait for factual accuracy to 100%, and if we wait for everything to be in place before we make our move, it's never going to happen. I think also we need to be careful.
I don't know what that means. Well, to me, it means I need to get people out of Congress that are voting for the military budget. And I can stand here and scream in the streets all I want to, and until I change the political system, and I vote for American system. You know, I don't want to go into an anarchist system where every time a group of people don't like something, whether it be for God's reason, for anybody else's reason, you're just willing to throw it up and have bloodshed in the streets, that kind of thing. And I don't think that's going to work. That's what's so neat about America. We can vote the turkeys out of office and change what can be done.
We have 6 more minutes, and then there's Conklin here. And then after Conklin, those who want to stay around to deal with this longer, great. Mary over here, and then Dan, and then over here. That may take care of our time.
Well, first of all, I don't think anybody that's a tax resister is naive enough to think it's going to do anything. I'm not naive enough to think that if I speak to somebody about the love of Jesus, that that's necessarily going to cause a metanoia in their life and they're going to change. It's a symbolic action, as has been said many times, and we're called to be faithful, not to make it come out right. And if I feel that that is a faithful action, I am compelled to do it and let God take that action and do with it what God will. And the other thing is, it's not a way of paying less money. You'll probably pay more because the IRS will come and take it out of your bank account plus interest, and I would like to put that money that I do not pay into a special fund, and there are many that work for peace. And if you keep your income below the taxable level, that doesn't let you off the hook either. You're not paying any taxes. But I think you have to be all the more generous then in making sure that you also support programs that you feel very strongly about, social programs and justice issues and things like that. I mean, just keeping your income below a taxable level still means that you have to be extra generous, I think, in where you give.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the gospel for Sunday is the seed and the mustard seed growing to great proportions, and it's also the farmer who plants and goes to bed and the seed grows. And there's something you said about being faithful to the gospel and not planting the seed and letting it grow and not worrying about is it going to work and will my efforts have any great effect on the United States government. If you're faithful to the gospel, to what you believe, you have to do.
But hopefully we can still kind of vote the churches out.
It's not just one thing that we do. It's not like I'm going to withhold my taxes and not do anything else. There are probably maybe 10 things you can do, that being one of them.
Look, you change people's hearts as well as what they're doing. That's why a robot goes against a submarine.
Yeah. You know, what I've mentioned is the summary and our call to be faithful and not to, you know, our call is not to make things turn out right, or God does that. That's what we mean by faith alone. That, for me, that relates so much to the question of the Soviet Union, will they take over the world, that all just for me to say that, I don't want to say that for anybody else, but for me to say that, I feel within myself is a way of saying you know, that God is not Lord of history and God is not Lord of the Russians. God is not, you know, is God Lord of the Soviet Union? If we look at the prophets of the Old Testament, Jesus is in the same spirit that when Yahweh is finished with the Soviet Union, he'll go, and that'll be it for them. When God is finished with the United States, and then God has something else, as God brings the universe to shalom. Do we believe that? Do we trust? Now, that is a hard question because my reason tends to fight that. But still.
The comment over here?
Oh, I guess I don't know if I'm too sensible or what, but before I do something, I like to have an objective in mind. And I don't think I know what the objective here is and what the result of the objective will be. I don't think I really understand what we're trying to do in the end, what our total end result is, and even if we do achieve it, what that objective, end objective, what it will accomplish in totality, you know. And before I do something, I'd like to at least have an objective out there to work on, to have a good feeling for that what I'm working towards is something good to work for.
Okay, and comment back here.
Well,
let me not time
it. I would like to speak about what you said, since it's a little time. I'd like to comment on what what this gentleman said. I agree with him. I think that's right, but in saying that, we also should look at what God said the end of the world was going to be like in Revelation. He's going to choose the time, he's going to choose the method, and it's going to be his plan. So we shouldn't, if we agree with that, then we shouldn't be really worried about a nuclear war. If that's how God chooses to end the world, that's how he chooses. And if not, then he won't allow it to happen. Whether we trust God.
That might be an interesting note to call a halt. No, because I think it will be enough to have us, after we close with evening prayer, that those of you who wish to stick around, we can